This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai, haere mai. It's good to have you along for Country Life. I'm Carol Stiles.
Kia ora, and I'm Duncan Smith. Today, we're meeting a man who thinks he has the best job out. He visits protected trees around the country.
We're getting up close and personal with some rams as they have their annual checkup.
Later on, it's a pig's day out at the Canterbury Showgrounds.
And we're winemaking for a good cause in the Waipara Valley.
But first, our look around the country. The far north has had a fair bit of sun, a wee bit of wind and no rain. It's still getting good pasture growth, although it has gone off from the superb surge at the end of last month. More rain is needed as soil moisture levels are still fairly low. With settled conditions, farmers can attend to their jobs, like controlling the troublesome invasive pasture weed, parsley dropwort or carrot weed. The price of Wiener Friesian bulls has gone up. Apparently there aren't too many available, as farmers are holding on to them to finish in the good conditions. There have been a few showers around Pukekohe, but it's been mainly fine. Growers are taking action to control thrips and mildew in onion crops. The first of the early new season's onions have matured over the past 2 weeks and are being hand-clipped before sale.
Our contact in Waikato says growing conditions are about as good as they get. They're making silage and new crops are doing well. With border restrictions, labour's still a bit of a worry, and the farmer was off to a meeting to discuss the farm employment situation. In King Country, a farmer was dagging sheep when we rang. His lambs were enjoying the sun on their back after some nasty cold showers which came through this week. He'd been to a Romney ram sale the previous day where 100 rams were sold and averaged $1,070 each, which is pretty good, he says.
The Bay of Plenty is seeing the benefits now of the rain a fortnight ago. A dairy farmer says he's been able to shut up paddocks to make silage. The thing now is to maintain good quality pasture. A lot of farmers are in a very happy place at the moment, although he says there are some niggling frustrations due to the global pandemic. Nature's gone wild in Taranaki. The warmth and damp makes it feel almost subtropical. A farmer there says they could do with 20% more cows to help manage the huge pasture growth. Contractors are run off their feet, topping and fitting in silage making between the spells of rain. A powerful speaker at a rural support dinner one night this week spoke about mental health and had farmers tuned in. Our contact says he's enjoying showing the region to visiting rural folk from other parts of the country who haven't been able to go off on farm tours overseas.
A grower in Gisborne says the area is in nice shape after a bit of everything on the weather front. They're coming to the tail end of the planting season for annual crops. Soil condition is really good. Early harvest of crops like sweet corn starts in a couple of weeks. Vineyard workers have been plucking and trimming and generally managing the vine canopy and keeping things tidy. The summer fruit harvest is underway in Hawke's Bay and yields are pretty good. Apple thinning has started. Heat units are running 40% above average, which bodes well for fruit size and means the crop might be 10 days earlier than normal. We're told it's probably the best spring they've seen, coming on top of the benefits of a dry winter. No waterlogging around the tree roots. Soil profiles are now full and growers don't need to worry about irrigation until the new year.
Manawatū has plenty of grass and stock are looking great. Farmers on the lower country are selling their top lambs and putting cull ewes to the works. The guys in the hills are starting weaning. It's a bit of an unknown how the lamb markets are going to go. There's an ongoing shortage of labour, especially in the more remote locations. Neighbours will often help each other out if they can't get casual labour. The farmer we called in Wairarapa had been out on a horse trek at the coast and says it's been a long time since the region had a spring like this. Going on horseback for 5 days is a good way to have a nosy at how other farms are doing, and she says stock are looking really good. Sheep trucks will be busy as weaning starts and lambs start to go off to the works. With the interruption to supply chains because of the pandemic, she's watching to see if and how a possible shortage of container space out of New Zealand affects primary produce exports.
Farms in the Tasman region are looking terrific, the best they've looked all year. A bit of rain midweek held up silage and baleage contractors, but otherwise they've been under the pump playing catch-up. Soil moisture levels are now good, although aquifers haven't come back up yet, and more rain's needed before Christmas. Stock are doing really well because of the excellent conditions. Marlborough's had about 10 millimetres of rain. A lawn mowing contractor says it's the growthiest season for many years, and baleage contractors are similarly flat out. Some paddocks are already getting second cuts, which is great for when things turn dry, as farmers still very much feel they will. Aquifers haven't built up here yet either. With temperatures in the mid-20s, lambs are bolting away with the feed in front of them. This is the case in the north of the region anyway. It's drier near Blenheim and south.
The west coast is looking stunning. After nice sun and some nitrogen, grass is finally growing. Last week's Agfest field days in Greymouth attracted a heap of people, and some stallholders sold a bit, including tractors. Dairy farmers are ending their first rounds of AI with the cows. Our contact hosted a tour group from the North Island this week. He says they probably wouldn't have checked out Westland if it wasn't for the border closure. Silage contractors are flat out here as well. The past 2 weeks are the first time they've really been able to crack into the work because it's been so wet. Some warm weather at the start of this week made Canterbury farmers wonder where the big rain they received a couple of weeks ago had gone. Grass and crops have certainly responded, so baleage and silage contractors are busy. On one farm, spring planting is finally finished, with a hemp crop in a paddock of lucerne being planted. He says it'll be nice to put the drill away until February, when they start again.
South Otago is also looking good. Again, silage contractors are cracking into the work. Lambs are starting to head to the meatworks. Sprinklings of rain are keeping things ticking along, and winter crops have eventually been sown. Southland's had a good couple of weeks now. Grass is pumping and everyone is happy. Farmers are getting ready to wean lambs, and they're still talking about the unrealistic government-proposed deadlines for planting winter crops. The now-delayed plan said crops had to go in before the start of this month. Some are only finishing the job now.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
We're heading to North Canterbury now, where a massive 6-kilometre-long deer fence is being built on Tim and Sue Anderson's Conway Flat Farm. It's hoped this will keep pests out of a 200-hectare area of regenerating bush the Andersons are retiring and placing into a covenant. Rural reporter Maya Burry paid Tim a visit to find out more.
A lot of history to the place, but my history or my father's and grandfather's history started in 1945 after the Second World War, and I'm the third generation and my son Edward will be the fourth.
And what's your operation here?
Well, we're basically, our primary income is selling rams to the industry, so we've got a couple of studs and we breed rams and try and ship them around the country.
And how is farming going at the moment?
Well, it's uncertain times. I think everyone appreciates that farmers are an important part of the life of New Zealand at the moment, but it's just uncertain because we don't know where the world markets will go and what's going to happen. And of course, wool's very disappointing if you're a crossbred breeder. But no, we're still doing it because we enjoy it.
Can you talk a bit more about the covenant? So what's the dream here? And it sounds like it's more or less a reality.
Yeah, well, it's going up now and it's 6 kilometres of deer fence, which is no small feat. It's going to be over 200 hectares of farm retired, but of course it was mainly bush at any rate, or scrub. We've got a lot of pittosporiums and whitey woods and koais, and there's some lovely matais, but it's predominantly manuka and kānuka. But, you know, there's a lovely lot of regenerating going on, and it will only increase now with the QE2 fencing. It'll be nice just to leave the trees to posterity, and I think it's all a positive.
Do you think it's quite a big, I guess, milestone for the farm?
Oh, it's a big milestone. It's probably the single biggest thing I've done in my 55 years farming in one go. But, you know, we've been lucky to have support, and I'm lucky my family have got behind me, because I think initially they wondered what the hell we were doing. But, yeah, no, it's all go now.
Now, for those wanting to know more about covenants and how they work, we've got just the person. Miles Giller is the North Canterbury Regional Representative for the QE2 National Trust that partners with private landowners like Tim and Sue to protect natural and cultural heritage sites. It's a job he's had for about 20 years.
Well, the Trust was formed in the 1970s with its own Act of Parliament by landowners, by farmers who wanted to be able to protect special values on private land, but not necessarily to sell it or give it to the Crown. There's an Act of Parliament, and that's provided a means by which landowners can enter into covenants with QE2 to provide legal protection for a whole range of what we call open space values.
And once you turn something into a covenant, it's pretty hard to untangle it, isn't it?
It's extremely hard to untangle it.
Yeah.
I think the word is indefeasible. A covenant cannot be annulled.
Do you know roughly how many covenants we're talking about in New Zealand?
It's over 4,500. It's a growing number all the time. I haven't got the exact figure, but it's. I remember when I started work, it was 1,500. So it's grown a lot in the last 20-odd years, yeah. It's going up by roughly over 100 every year.
Perhaps it's something people are considering more often.
I think it's becoming a bit more mainstream here, for sure. Probably when covenants were first initiated, it was a bit of a radical sort of a thing to do, but now it's becoming really parcel of good land custodianship. Not oddball at all. I've got about half a dozen proposals on my desk at the moment that I'm looking at. And then, of course, my time has also spent quite a bit with monitoring existing covenants because having a legal document to protect a covenant area is one thing, but we want to know that the aspirations of that covenant are actually being achieved. So a large part of a QE2 rep's job is also getting out there and visiting the landowner every couple of years, seeing how the covenant's getting on, helping them to address any issues that may arise.
What a great job getting to go out onto all those farms.
It's my dream job, I must admit. I don't really want to retire. I suppose I'll have to at some stage, but a great way of getting out there and thinking that you're making a difference too, helping landowners do something really constructive.
Miles Giller from the QE2 National Trust. He was speaking to rural reporter Maya Burry.
And we had a great response to the competition for a copy of the new book, Homesteads, the story of New Zealand's grand country houses, written and published by Deborah Miller. The answer to the questions about Merkeston were, the architect was John Madison, it took 3 years to build and has a whopping 23 fireplaces. Congratulations to Tracy Jury. Your name was pulled from the hat. We'll pop the book in the post to you.
Wouldn't fancy being the maid who had to clean and re-prepare all those 23 fireplaces.
Bit of a job.
Hi, I'm Jane McCall, owner of the Flying Fox accommodation on the Whanganui River. You're listening to Country Life, RNZ National.
Now, as you probably know, the Christchurch-based New Zealand Agricultural Show was cancelled this year, but some of the animal events went ahead nonetheless. Cosmo popped in to find out about a pig competition and caught up with the president of the Boar Breeders Association, Sean Spencer.
So we're at the pavilion at the Canterbury Park and we're here for the commercial Boar Breeders pig competition.
And it's quite strange because there's hardly anyone here, whereas obviously normally by now there would be thousands of people mingling and looking at all the animals.
Yeah, there'd be thousands of people. It really is bedlam, which does make it kind of special, I suppose, for us. And hopefully everyone will be back in the show next year.
Because I guess your event here, the boar competition, would be quite a popular event to watch.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we generally have about 300 or 400 people watching. Last year we had 34 entrants, so there's probably 6 people in each syndicate, so quite the following.
So have you had a drop in the amount of syndicates that are entering pigs because of COVID?
Yeah, definitely. We were sort of hit with a bit of a curveball, really, around the show not going ahead, so we were a bit worried because generally people will come up for the races and the show and they'll bring a pig along as well. So to be honest, I thought we were going to probably get about 15 entrants, but to get 24 this year, down from 34 last year, I'm really happy. Yeah.
And how far afield are they coming from?
So we have got a pig coming down from Napier this year. There's a crew from Tiana as well, so yeah, very far afield.
Now, we're standing in front of a very fine-looking pig.
Yeah, we probably haven't had him as long as we wanted, but he is looking pretty good. He's nice and deep-ribbed, full through the body, got good hams, and he's got his little mate there to keep him company, so, I think he'll have a good chance today.
And where do they live normally?
So these pigs have been raised out in Darfield, so we've just got to shelter them from the wind out there, and they've come away quite nicely.
And what sort of feed are they getting this morning?
It looks like they've got a bit of grain in there, and they'll get a few pig pellets as well.
Yes, a few treats.
Yeah.
Now tell me about the competition. How does it work?
In the past, we have selected sort of the top 10 pigs to come into the arena, but because we've got all the time today, every pig is going to go into the arena and have their chance to show what they've got and do what they need to do, so yeah.
And I can see a polished cup standing on a table just across the way there.
Yeah, the Ramstein Memorial Trophy. Yep, it's quite a prestigious award. $500 prize money as well, and yeah.
Tell me about the syndicates, because people tend to come in groups, don't they, entering groups?
Yeah, and it's definitely encouraged because it's a good opportunity for people and friends to get together, I suppose, and raise a pig, and they're quite nice animals. And yeah, we hold a, well, it sort of just started happening, really. People started dressing up, and then we introduced the best dress competition, and that's probably been just as big as the pig showing, really. So we'll go in for the barbecue, and then we'll have a bit of a runway for everyone to walk up and down. And
like a catwalk.
Yeah. Yeah. We had some guys in their old school uniforms with the short shorts.
Squeezing into them.
Yeah. We've had the dungarees. We sort of get all sorts, really. It's a bit of a spectacle. And
so it's quite a social
Very
event.
Social, yeah. And that's what we encourage. It is all about the fun for us. And then there's obviously the Boar Breeders' Ball tonight. So, yeah.
Fun.
Yeah.
What are some of the syndicate names?
We have the Streaky Strokers. And we've got the Pork Pullers, Pigs at Work, the Slug Genetics. Yeah, the names are very creative. Yeah.
And tell me about the Boar Association. When did it start and who started it?
Yeah, it was started by James Pearce back in 2015. He lived over in Canada and he worked for a guy who used to show pigs over there. And when he came back to New Zealand, he was keen to sort of give it a go here, and he entered a pig and he won, pretty much because he was the only one in show. But from there, it's sort of grown exponentially, and yeah, it's got a really good following now.
Yes. Oh, there's another entrant approaching us. That's quite a large pig.
Yeah, it is a large pig. This pig's come all the way from Kurau, so he's well travelled, but I think, yeah, the boys will be pretty hopeful today.
What sort of pigs are these? What breeds are they?
So we've got probably a large white cross with a Berkshire. This fella here is a Berkshire pig. We've got some Tamworth pigs down there. We're not too specific on breed, but generally the pigs will be between 6 and 8 months. And it being a commercial class, we're looking for that best eating pig, so you don't want to leave them too long, I suppose.
Yes. What are the judges looking for?
Good balance between muscle and fat, nice fat cover, a nice, well-rounded animal, big hams. And the judges today, we've got a butcher from Canterbury Homekill, and we have a pig farmer, Simon King, and we have Tim Black, who is a bar owner from Timaru, so he's there just to tie it all together.
A good variety of talent there.
Yeah.
What about temperament, animal temperament? Does that come into play?
Yeah, generally you want to make sure your animals are comfortable around people. I think today not rushing the pigs will be really good because they are quite territorial, sort of. They can be aggressive at times, but I mean, they look pretty calm today. Making sure they've got enough food and water will keep them pretty sound.
There's another entrant. What sort of pig is that?
I want to say that's a
Berkshire
Duroc
Cross.
Yeah.
So half and half. It's come out looking like a Duroc, but it's got a Berkshire nose.
How much work goes into preparing a pig for this event?
A bit, yeah, because they're definitely very hungry animals, so if you can get the right food into them, it definitely makes a big difference. And generally you have them for probably about 5 months, 4 or 5 months, feeding them up, and then getting them ready for the show. As you'll see, all these pigs are very clean and washed, and some of them will probably start to look a bit shiny closer to 10 when all the babe oil and the secret products come out. So, yeah.
Once you have a winner, will that pig go on to become a breeding pig? What will happen to it?
Good question. It really comes down to the owner, but I think when Ramstein won the first competition, he went on to be a breeding pig, and his genetics have sort of carried on in this competition. And we had a Heritage Berkshire boar last year win the competition, so he's carried on and been kept as a breeding pig.
Yes. The pens are starting to fill up, and I guess by, 10 o'clock, it'll be show on.
Show on, definitely. Definitely, it'll be great.
President of the Boar Breeders Association, Sean Spencer, ending that story. Now, the winning pig for 2020 was a large white from North Canterbury's Fedora Boar Importers Syndicate. Sounds like something out of The Godfather.
Now, people often ask us how we find our stories. Well, a couple of months ago, I was reading the Waitomo News and saw an ad. The local vets, VetEnt, were asking farmers to book in for their dog and ram run. I didn't know such a thing existed, so I asked if I could tag along. Veterinarian Tara Gower works out of the Te Kuiti office and had a list of farm visits scheduled, 26 rams to see on the first property, as well as a couple of ageing working dogs. But she also had a passenger in her ute.
Did you say the noisiest little thing ever? This is Bear. He is a five-week-old Bairdi Huntaway cross. So his mum is half and half Bairdi and Huntaway, and his dad's a Huntaway. And he will be a working dog. Although at the moment he's a spoiled only child because I hand-read him from 2 days old. So,
well, what happened to his mum?
His mum's still about. She is on the station that I live on. And she, well, it wasn't actually her fault. Somebody bit him and he had a nasty infection. And he had a big infection on his rump, and we ended up having to amputate the end of his tail because a tooth had gone right through his spine. And so he was on the way out, basically. We found him cold and really unwell on the side of the kennel. And mum wasn't trying to feed him anymore. I think he'd given up on feeding. So I treated him and hand-read him, got him back to healthy, and tried to pop him with his mum, who at that point had decided he didn't smell like hers and she didn't want him. So now he's stuck with me, coming on ram and dog runs.
Does he make beautiful noises?
So sometimes. Sometimes they're loud and don't stop.
With Bear safely back in his crate, it's time for Tara to get out her stethoscope and turn her attention to some more senior dogs. They're getting their annual checkup. Farm visits are scheduled for this time of year between docking and shearing, when hopefully farmers aren't rushed off their feet. Bruce and Grizz are part of the team on Annette Hooper's farm, a few k's out of Te Kuiti.
Hello, Bruce. Hello, darling.
He's a Huntaway and he's 12 years old, yes.
Has he been a good dog?
Yes, yes and no. He won't listen.
We have trouble
getting him to do as he's told. He's got worse as he got older.
So his heart and lungs sound good. His teeth have got a wee bit of tartar there, but no chips or cracks or anything of concern, just a little bit of tartar that's built up over his ears. Okay. Check his ears for you since he's not listening. Have a feel of his tummy. For working dog checks, we will do a nose-to-tail exam. So we'll start off just checking that their teeth are fine, have a look at their face in general, check their eyes and ears. And then I'll have a listen to the chest to make sure that all of the heart sounds and lung sounds are normal. A feel of the abdomen to make sure there's no lumps or bumps or anything that shouldn't be there. And a good look over their coat. And then if they're entire, which farm dogs usually are, I'll just have a feel of the mammary glands and the testicles if it's a male, and ask about recent heats if it's a female, just to make sure everything's working as it should.
So he's quite an old dog, Bruce. Is he still working for you?
Oh, yes, he does still work, but he's getting very slow.
Good lad.
He runs out of puff. Don't ya?
Are you just giving him an injection?
Yes, a combination vaccination for leptospirosis, and the other segment is a 5-in-1, but the most important bit that we're vaccinating against is the parvovirus.
Hey, Bruce.
And this is a tablet for fleas and ticks. Works for 3 months, so that hopefully they won't get any flea infestations over the summer, which is when we see most of the fleas.
He obviously quite likes that.
Yep, it's got some beef flavouring in it, So most dogs will eat it. You get the odd one who's a bit smart and knows that there's some medication hidden in there. But he says, yes, please.
You mentioned parvo before.
Yes.
What is it?
So it is a really nasty virus. They get severe vomiting and diarrhoea. Most commonly affects puppies, but you can see it in older dogs as well. And it's really, really contagious and lives in the ground for years and years. So if you do have it on your property, then it's on your property, even if you haven't had dogs there for a long time. And what it does is that they get really, really unwell, lethargic, go off their food, get very dehydrated, and quite often end up dying a horrendous death. It's really nasty.
So you're doing the rounds at the moment. How many farmers actually bring their dogs to you for this same treatment?
Yeah, we do get some, especially the pups. But all the older dogs, if we're going around into the area, it makes more sense for us to come to them. We've got 16 dogs at one property a bit later. Good luck getting 16 dogs into your ute. So it makes more sense for us to come around, especially if we're doing the rams anyway. And it also means we get on farm, we have a bit of a chat and can see our clients in their own environment rather than just in the clinic where we might have a few other things going on at once. Cool, that's him all done.
He's all done.
Yep.
Right, come on. Hey, Bruce.
Next out of his run is Grizz. He's a shy, medium-sized hunterway with a whiskery muzzle, grey hairs at the back of his neck and an endearing face.
Come on, Grizz. Come on, Grizzy boy.
The only trouble is, Grizz doesn't like being touched.
Is he another older dog?
Yes, he's about 10.
Right, darling. Good lad, he's definitely a bit cloudy in the eyes.
Yes. Can't you do anything for cataracts?
A specialist vet can. We can refer you.
I was going to
But not
say.
As GPs, no.
No, yeah. Costs a bit, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. But, unfortunately, with veterinary medicine, it's not subsidised like humans, so we see the costs.
Didn't
like that very much. Hey, Chris. You all right? Hey, darling. You all right, Chris? Come on. It's all right, Chris.
No.
Don't be naughty. Chris is not too keen on the old checking over. Doesn't want his testicles felt by the look of that.
Good boy. You don't mind needle, though.
No.
The front end's fine, the back end's not.
Oh, Grizz, don't be silly.
You're all right.
Hey, Grizz.
Good boy.
When you're trying to check his testicles, what are you looking for?
So quite commonly in entire dogs, they can get like a prostatitis, which quite often is hormone related. So that would be a rectal exam, but obviously with Grizz, that was not a possibility. But they can just get swollen or a little bit softer than normal, or lumps and bumps. And testicular cancer is something that we see in dogs as well. So we'd be able to feel that, any abnormality really.
And what percentage of dogs let you do that to them?
Most will. Working dogs generally are actually really tolerant. They love some pets. Quite often if they're in bigger teams, then they might not get as many pets as they'd like. So if we're coming up and we're giving them a bit of a pat and a rub while we're looking them over, then they think it's great. And especially if they're getting a flea treatment because it tastes yum. For the most part, they think vets are awesome. Grizz was just particularly, I'm not sure, protective, I suppose, of the family jewels. But most are really tolerant.
Next, it's down the hill to the yards to check out the rams. There are a couple of dozen stocky and tidy-looking Poll Dorsets and Coopworths waiting to be seen.
So this is a
an overalls job?
Yes, this is an overalls job. Sometimes it's a wet weather gear job, depending on if the rams are wet or if they've been crutched. So I'll be in the race with them behind them, and then as I move through, you let the one that you're finished with go. Well, I'll let it go behind me. And you've really got to watch your back because they really like being with their friends. So sometimes they'll run back at you and they push past your knees as well. So you've got to be quite careful that they don't push past your knees and hurt your knees. They can bunt as well. They usually bunt each other. But if you get a really stroppy one, then they'll back up and then ram you, which is probably where they get the name from, I guess.
Do you need any special equipment for this?
Just gloves. Come on, boys.
They're big, aren't they?
Yeah, they're fairly big boys. Makes it a wee bit harder to make them go where you'd like them to go. So at the moment at the back of a race full of rams.
You're crouched down behind the backside of a ram.
That's right. And I'm basically just feeling the testicles for anything unusual. Sometimes they jump around, they don't really appreciate it, but it's a necessary thing to be done to make sure that your flock health is all under control. It's funny, actually, at uni we're taught that when we're palpating them they should be about the size of a tui can. I'm not sure why a tui, because all the cans seem to be very similar sizes in the beer shelf.
Does every sheep farmer have this done?
Most do, yeah. Some do opt not to, but for the most part you have it done, because if you're not getting your ewes and lamb, then you're missing out on production, so it's worthwhile doing. Ram sales are around about this time of the year for stud breeders who are selling rams, so it's a good time for us to check that they're brucella free, which is the main disease that we're looking for when we palpate. And we do the rest of the, even the commercial rams as well this time of the year. They won't go out with the ewes, it depends really on the area of the country, but quite often until March in most places or April.
If they do have brucella, what will you feel or what will you see?
Brucella is a bacteria that gets into the epididymis, so it's actually the part that's next to the testicle. It's sort of the storage place for sperm, and it turns hard and lumpy if they have brucella. We're trying to obviously get rid of brucella in your flocks because it's really contagious and passes between rams really easily.
And what does it do to them?
It makes them infertile. It gives us a bit of time doing it this early to fix anything if there's a problem that's fixable. Like mange, we could treat it in time for them to be all good again for mating season.
What's mange?
Mites. Yeah, mites that like to get in amongst it on the ram's testicles. Yeah.
They all good?
They're all good, yep. No lumps. You get the odd one that's got something else going on, like just had a look at one that's lame. So we've treated that one, and then a couple that have got infections, one on the neck and one up on its ear, the poor lad. Handy thing to have on farm is some wet wipes and hand soap. Just kept in the ute in case there's no water or soap handy nearby.
Well, you need it really, because you've been dealing with some pretty mucky things.
These ones are quite clean because I've been dagged or crutched recently. But yeah, you get some where the shearers haven't been round yet or the farmers haven't quite got to them, and your arms get fairly green.
Did you always want to work with sheep?
Probably not, if you'd asked me when I first wanted to be a vet, which was years and years ago. If I wanted to work with sheep, like only sheep, no, probably not. And even now, although I enjoy working with them, I really enjoy all aspects of the sheep and beef farming systems. But no, I was on the equine track for a wee while. Grew up a horsey girl, so I was quite keen on chasing that one, and then met a farmer, as you do sometimes, and now I'm living quite rurally anyway, and there's not many horses around.
Do you ever get to do surgery?
Yes, yep. Now we do quite a lot of surgery. So ram vasectomies are coming up. So we do them on farm, usually just in the woolshed. Do caesareans on cows if they're having too much trouble calving, which is just in the yards or a head bale, if you're lucky enough to have those facilities.
Did you do any caesareans this year?
I only had to do one, which was nice, although the time of the night wasn't nice. It was about 2 a.m. by the time we got to deciding that caesarean was necessary.
And was it a pedigree animal?
Nope, just a dairy cow. Yep. But a good dairy cow and a live calf out of it, so she's cycled again too, which is always nice to hear. Good feedback from the farmers that it was a nice, successful surgery. You know that the decision made on the night to go to caesarean was a good one.
Tell me about the ram vasectomies.
I mean, similar to people, I suppose, except we don't do people in a woolshed, do we? you find the vas deferens, which is the cord that carries the sperm from the testicles, and you take a wee bit of that out and tie it off so that although they still have all the hormones, they can't get the job done, they can't get the ewes and lamb.
Why would a farmer want a vasectomised ram?
Yeah, so they're called teaser rams. You put them out before you put your other entire rams that have not been vasectomised out, and it just gets the ewes all cycling. It can sort of trigger them to cycle a little bit earlier, so hopefully everybody or more of the ewes that would have otherwise get in lamb earlier on in the lambing season, in the mating season.
Are they widely used?
Teasers? Yeah, bigger stations mostly.
Do you use vasectomised rams?
No. No.
Vet Tara Gower and farmer Annette Hooper. We have some photos on our webpage, including one of the five-week-old puppy Bear.
From beer to wine. Grape growers around the country are busy tending to their precious vines. Viticulturist Pete Chapman from Terrace Edge on the south bank of the Waipara River in North Canterbury has been putting in some long hours on the tractor this week. Cosmo Kentish Barnes caught up with Pete on the organic vineyard to find out how things are going.
We bought this land in 1999. It was always a family project, so I got interested in it when I was still at school and went on to study. And yeah, gradually it started as a weekend hobby and gradually got completely out of control and fully-fledged business now. So yeah, it's been a process from that year of planting out. And now to this day, we've got 13 and a half hectares of vines, and we've got an olive grove well also of about 5 hectares.
Yes. Yeah. Did the olive trees go in first? Because they look quite established.
They did. That was the first thing we got stuck into. Yeah.
And tell me about the grapes here. What sort of varieties do you grow?
Yeah, we're in one of our oldest Pinot Noir blocks here, and it's been growing really quite nicely, apart from we've had challenges of a few frosts, and they're actually flowering earlier than I've seen for a very long time. So yeah, this warm conditions we've got, we're tracking ahead of usual, which is not a bad thing. Yeah, they're shaping up really nicely.
Was the vineyard originally a conventional operation? When did you switch to organics?
We started the vineyard in 1999 and started planting out, and just really were learning as we went and started conventionally. And then it wasn't until 2011 that we started the organic process of certification.
What prompted you to head in that direction?
Well, it was actually watching a neighbour go through the process and seeing the results. It was really just thinking about sort of having to put on all this gear and not touch these chemicals we were putting on, and then thinking about the fact that we were actually eating that, which didn't make a lot of sense. So it was around longevity for the land and around, you know, health of people, and most importantly, actually, we believe that it makes better wine.
So what have been some of your biggest learning curves since you've gone organic?
Really, for us, the biggest difference is the management of weeds around the vines, and that's involved just learning good techniques and getting good equipment. We've got some good systems now for dealing to those, but if you imagine trying to weed right up around the base of each vine, around, you know, 30 or 40,000 vines is quite a job. So yeah, that's probably been one of the biggest learning curves, but as far as that, we just use all, it's sort of not a thing of do nothing. Some people sort of think organic is just don't really do much, let them do their thing. But we have to be very proactive, putting on a lot of natural compounds which will prevent disease rather than coming in and trying to eradicate any issues. Yeah.
And do you put plants in between the vines to control pests?
We do. We're just actually setting that up today. You'll see some of these rows have been cultivated. They're just about to run through again, and then we'll go through with our seed drill to plant species such as Vasselia, buckwheat, and these ones have been proven at Lincoln University actually to attract a little beneficial wasp, which then goes to the grape flowers and kills any caterpillars. We get issues with caterpillars in the industry, causing disease late season. So really nice organic method there of that really does work. Yeah.
Would that be the leaf roller caterpillar?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, which can do heaps of damage.
It certainly can. It's an issue in a lot of crops, and yeah, one which is pretty cool to be able to deal to organically.
Now tell me about the soil here. Yeah. What is it about this soil that helps make great wine?
Yeah, we believe that the organic processes we've been using for many years has made it even better than it was when we first got here. But starting from the base, it's got a nice fertile sort of silt loam topsoil, but then goes down to these gravel parent material underneath. And the vines have really sunk their roots down into that now. And yeah, we find that it naturally devigorates the vines a bit. And what you find, if a vine has to work a little bit harder, it sometimes will produce a more concentrated, flavoursome fruit. So it's a combination of things. And we have found that our organic matter over time has increased, which is such an important thing for a soil. And everything we do sort of aimed at looking after that side of things that you can't even see.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Do you have sheep coming in?
Yeah, we use sheep for grazing down the weeds around the vines. So that's a really nice element to have that animal influence on the soil and deal to the weeds. And then also occasionally we bring them in later in the season, and it's quite amazing, they'll tend to pluck the leaves from around the fruit. Mm. And if you do it at the right time when the bunches are still green, haven't got enough sugar yet, they don't like the taste of the grape. And you have to watch them like a hawk though, because there is the odd one that might get a taste for it and then they tell their mates, and before you know it, I have heard of people ending up with very little crop. So it's one of those balancing acts.
And business-wise, how are things going in terms of, you know, running a high-end boutique vineyard?
Yeah, it's been a real roller coaster with, you know, COVID hit in harvest time of the 2020 vintage. And initially we weren't even sure whether we were going to be able to harvest the grapes, but we were deemed essential industry. Mm. And that was great. We got to just carry on and do our thing, just abiding by, you know, a number of new rules and regulations. Mm. But yeah, brought in a beautiful crop. And I think that was the same for a lot of the industry throughout the country, which is fantastic. And yeah, so we were concerned about obviously how sales would go. They have reduced for us in some markets, but then other ones such as our tasting room, where we have had a number of tourists come, we thought, you know, surely it's going to slow down, but we've had huge take up of domestic tourism and we're actually increased sales. We're well above what we were last year at our tasting room, where we give a really nice sort of family presentation of the wines. And yeah, it's great to be able to see that area growing, that direct to customer.
Mm. How interesting that your business in the tasting room's gone up since COVID.
I wouldn't have picked it, but yeah, it's a great little bonus. As I say, though, other parts down, but that is the area we'd love to keep growing, because we find for a boutique, smaller producer like ourselves, if we can have direct customer sales, it's really great.
Yes, and of course your tasting room does happen to have a wonderful view over the terrace, doesn't it?
Mm, yeah, no, it's a great place for people to come and try the wine, and then they can visit one of the steepest vineyards in the country. Actually, we grow Syrah, which is unique for the region, on this 45-degree slope. Yeah.
And what sort of flavour does that Syrah have?
Ours is more like that cooler climate French style, and it gets a lot of spice. It gets really hot during the day, but then cools down during the night, which is this unique diurnal sort of variation between temperature. And that's what you find in cool climate viticulture. If you can get that happening, then you retain acidity, but then you also get these all these lovely flavours happening.
And when the grapes are harvested, where does the wine get made?
So yeah, we hand pick out most of our grapes and then we transport them. We don't have our own wine making facility on site here. We made that call right near the start that Muddy Water, who do some contract winemaking, Gavin Tate there, who actually went through university with, does our winemaking. And yeah, we've been working with them for a long time, and it's fantastic. They've got such a good facility that for me, there's just no point in everyone having their own one. They make the wines very much to the style that we want and collaborate really well, so it's fantastic.
Now tell me about your 27 Seconds wine label. How's that project going?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a quick little synopsis of what it is. Basically, my wife and I were travelling for India, and I've been in the wine industry a long time, and she was at the time working for an NGO, and we came across human trafficking and just wanted to do something to help, but felt rather like we couldn't, you know, in the wine industry. human trafficking, not really sort of a combination you'd know. But yeah, we eventually ended up deciding to make a wine brand that where 100% of the profits go to Hagar, who work with survivors of human trafficking in Afghanistan, Cambodia and Vietnam. So it's been a process. We've been going about 3 years now, but it's been fantastic. The adoption of it's been great. We knew right from the start the wine had to be good quality. People might, you know, identify with the cause the first time they try it, but they're only going to keep coming back if it's actually good wine. So most of the fruit has all come on from our own vineyard, so they're certified organic. And yeah, it's been fantastic to be able to combine two of my passions, I guess, you know, making nice wine and, yeah, trying to help the people that really need it.
What sort of human trafficking did you come across on your travels that made you want to do something to help?
Well, we were visiting friends in Calcutta who have developed a business primarily to help give people that have been caught up in the red light district of Calcutta, Sonagachi. And so it's an alternative employment there. And so we visited there, and Kerry, who developed that business, took us, Alana and I, through the red light district there. And it was a real eye-opener. And it was even more so when we came across some younger girls, and Alana asked where are those girls from, because they look different to the rest of the people there. And he explained to us that most probably that these younger girls will have been trafficked from Nepal, most probably with the promise of work in a restaurant or somewhere from large families, and their parents are quite happy to find good work for their children, and before they know it they're in a country which is a different language, different culture, and on their own, and being sold.
Yes, awful.
Yeah, pretty horrific.
Why have you called the label 27 seconds? What does it mean?
Yeah, well, we found that is a crazy stat from UNICEF that somewhere in the world a child every 27 seconds is sold or trafficked into slavery. So we, really moved by that crazy stat and just wanted to do something small to help.
How much money have you raised so far?
We've given $25,000 already, and we're about to give another similar donation soon. So we're looking forward to be giving a lot more in the future. Yes. But some of it obviously has to go to the costs of creating the wine.
Mm. And what sort of varieties of wine come under that label?
We make a Pinot Noir, Riesling, which are two that Waipara and North Canterbury are really well known for. And then we've got the Pinot Gris, Sauvignon Blanc. And I guess the 27 seconds would be more of a crowd pleaser commercial sort of style, whereas some of the Terrace Edge wine might be more, you know, instead of just being fruity, it might have more savoury and other complexities. So it's really aiming it for the price point and making what the consumer will be after and enjoy.
So nice for people who buy the wine to know that all the profits are going towards such a great cause.
Yeah, it's pretty cool about it to do something to help. But we have had a number of suppliers within the wine industry who have donated their time and continue to do so. One that really stands out is Mark Eder, the local contractor who does harvesting. Each year I've said to him, oh, if you could help us out a tiny bit, that'd be great. You know, we discount, that'd be cool. But he's gone and said that he'll do it all for free, the harvesting. So that's pretty amazing. There's been a number of really cool stories like that.
Very generous.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you get volunteers to do the picking as well, but of course this year you didn't because of COVID.
We hand-pick the red varieties and machine-pick the whites. So that's where the contractor comes in with the machine harvester. But with the reds in the past, we have had close to 25 people volunteer there Saturday to come and help pick grapes for what is such a worthy cause.
Is this a long-term project for you?
It started off not quite knowing how it would go, but it really has developed. And the most important thing is, you know, it's all very well us coming up with this idea, but it's the consumers that have really run with it. And we've gone from just thinking we'd sell it online to now being in almost all the New World supermarkets in Christchurch. And we see it as a really sustainable model of, you know, not every business's focus has to be creating profits for shareholders. You know, it can be doing something else with that money.
What's it like for you growing grapes, being in the outdoors? It's a lovely day today. How special is it for you to be here working on the land?
Yeah, I really enjoy it. It is farming at the end of the day. It has its ups and downs. You know, we were talking about frost before. So you can do everything you can, but Mother Nature will take its turn. But I love the concept of being able to work with the land and create something that's hopefully really nice and people enjoy, and that lasts for a long time in the bottle. It's pretty cool, pretty special thing about to do.
Viticulturist Pete Chapman talking to Cosmo at the Terrace Edge Vineyard in North Canterbury's Waipara Valley.
And that's another edition of Country Life. We'll be back again next week. Until then, bye now.
Bye.